Best-selling book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. His most recent book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, is out in paperback. We'll link to your piece. Blackwater founder remains free and rich while his former employees go down on murder charges. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Vienna, Austria, Friday at an event hosted by ORF, Austria's public broadcaster. Then on Saturday, I'll be speaking at the Elevate Festival in Graz, Austria. Check our website for details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berk, Renee Fels, Sarah Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Hey, fellow weirdo. This is Rich, host of Radio Lost and Found. Be sure to check out the show on its new time slot. That's every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found records, tapes, found sound, internet insanity, and more. That's Radio Lost and Found every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Hey, weirdo! Come out and play!
Good people, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion, addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. And by the League of Women's Voters of Portland, helping to make democracy work with printed and online voters' guides for the November election. You can check your library or voteoregon.org for more information and a guide personalized to your address. That's voteoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland voted yesterday to appeal the settlement between the City and the Department of Justice dealing with the excessive use of force by the Portland Police against the mentally disabled.
The Department of Justice has condemned the leaking of information from the ongoing investigation into the shooting death of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri.
And a tornado touched down in Washington's Cowlitz County this afternoon, resulting in property damage, but no reported injuries.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 23rd, 2014. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncord. The Portland City Council voted unanimously last night to file an appeal challenging part of the United States Justice Department settlement with the city on the excessive use of force by Portland police. The City Council argued that they should not have to appear before a judge every year for a public report on how the reforms are going. Instead, they argue, an internal city report that may or may not be public is sufficient. But community leaders disagree. They think that the city should stop appealing the settlement and just follow the judge's guidelines to reform the police of Portland. We'll speak with one of these community leaders, Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland, later this hour on KBOO News in Depth at 5:45. On a related note, in Ferguson, Missouri, some community leaders are putting their hopes on a Department of Justice service that has had personnel on the ground in Ferguson since late August. The Community Relations Service of the U.S. Department of Justice was formed in the civil rights era to be deployed to areas of racial and social unrest to try to mediate between the parties involved. They've held dozens of meetings with police, with residents, with community leaders, and nearly all of these meetings have been in secret. They have run town hall meetings closed to all but residents. They often ask attendees not to name names or talk specifics. Department officials in Washington, D.C., citing provisions of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that created this unit, won't even provide basic information on its employees or their work here. Days after the August 9th shooting of Mr. Brown by Fergus police officer Darren Wilson, the department announced that it would launch an investigation concurrent with St. Louis County's, which took over from Ferguson police. About a month later, following night after night of protests and violence, the department said it would expand its work into an examination of the use of force by police in Ferguson. But the Community Relations Service is entirely different from those three larger operations. It has no investigative authority. Its mediators have been in St. Louis quietly working on disputes long before Brown's death thrust Ferguson into the global consciousness. Its goal is not to make arrests or file lawsuits, but to give all sides a private place to talk and hopefully solve their own problems. Many people in Ferguson and across the country, however, question that technique and point out that the problem is not simply a difference of opinion that can be mediated on an individual level, but a systematic problem built into the structure of our society and method of governance. With the verdict from the grand jury on the killing of Michael Brown expected any day now, these questions will very likely be thrust once again into the national headlines once the verdict is announced.
On Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Justice condemned the release of leaked information from the ongoing investigation into the shooting death of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. The grand jury decision on whether Wilson should face charges over Brown's death is expected in November and has generated intense national media coverage. The St. Louis Dispatch and other national media outlets released the leaked information, which includes witness testimony, crime scene reports, and Brown's autopsy report, and all seem to support Officer Wilson's side of the story. The DOJ's condemnation of the leak stems from worries that unnamed sources are trying to influence public opinion in favor of Officer Wilson. The autopsy report contained the preliminary police account of the shooting, which has Brown struggling with Wilson while the officer was still in his patrol car, causing Wilson's gun to discharge unintentionally and strike Brown's hand. At this point, the report says, Brown began running away, Wilson demanded that he stop, and Brown turned and ran back. Then Wilson fired his weapon multiple times, killing Brown. Despite widespread attention and criticism directed at the leaks, the Brown family's attorney, Benjamin Crump, says that, quote, the crux of the matter is still the question of why Officer Wilson killed Brown when he was 20 feet away from the patrol car.
Several dozen Portlanders gathered last night in outer southeast Portland for a protest march in solidarity with the people of Ferguson, Missouri. Yesterday, October 22nd, marked a national day of action to end police brutality. In Portland, protesters walked around the intersection at Southeast 162nd and Stark, chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot," while the rain poured down. KBOO Radio was there and brings us the voices of some of the protesters.
Don't shoot! I'm out here because police are overcoming the communities and there's too many of them. And they're pulling you over for no reason at all. So it's not really a right thing. And they can't give you a punishment. Only judges can do that. But they're coming here asking for your name and pulling you over and checking you for no reason at all. I think they need to like calm down at least.
Have you ever had any experience with the police?
Yeah, like I was just walking down with my friends before and they like pulled us over for no reason at all, so wow.
How old are you?
I'm 11 years old.
And that was here in Portland?
Yeah.
And what do you think people should do about it?
I just think people should just like try to like post videos on Facebook and Instagram of the police doing what they're doing.
Yeah. I've been involved in a federal investigation of Portland police through an 18-month experience where they signed an agreement with the city of Portland to stop illegal use of force. I don't believe the agreement is actually going to achieve those goals. So I'm out here today to express solidarity with the people who don't even have that agreement in Ferguson. I'm hoping that the Department of Justice will return to Portland as one of five sites that they will designate to create better community understanding. We're boxed out of City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We get 3 minutes of testimony, mm-hmm. and they vote whatever it was that they had already arranged to come in.
Wow.
We don't get a deliberative body where the Portland Police Association mm-hmm. comes out and testifies in public. It's okay. all part of a behind-the-doors, closed-doors negotiation process that the people are presented with a fait accompli. So we need to figure out any way that we can to get into the public debate. So I'm glad KBOO's out here, and I'm a yes. KBOO member.
We have seen over and over that this, you know, violence doesn't stop violence. Violence only continues violence, and it increasingly is primarily the people who are disenfranchised the most, people of color. So I'm here to really show support for downsizing our police force.
I'm here because for too long there's been institutionalized racism, especially in our police force, especially in our housing policies, in our education system, especially in our prison system. And it's gone on too far and too many people have died. We make the mistake of assuming that a lack of violence equals peace. And that's not necessarily true, you know. Seeing people who are unfairly convicted for drug laws, or people who are harassed by police, and people who are, you know, kicked out of schools and sent to prison merely because of the color of the skin is not justice. And if there's not justice, it's not peace. Peace is more than the absence of conflict. It's the presence of justice.
You know, we're here because we're talking about police terrorism. You know, my position on police terrorism is that the role of the police is to repress people of color. So when I say the slave ship, that's true, because the police were never meant to protect and serve everybody here in this community.
I'm here today in solidarity with protesters in Ferguson in an attempt to get justice for Mike Brown's death and countless other people who have been victims of police brutality in this country.
There is essentially a war against African people and people of Latino and brown people all across the United States. And specifically in Portland, there was laws on the books where Africans couldn't live in certain areas. You couldn't. It was sundown town laws throughout all of Oregon, and so it's not surprising to find that police are still living up to that same brutality and those same laws. And they're finding other ways to enforce and other ways to terrorize our neighborhoods. We know that people got pushed out here to the hundreds because of gentrification, land grabs, let's just call it what it is. And when they're out here, there's lack of resources. And the police themselves fund initiatives in order to systematically target and monitor people that are forced out of here, specifically African and people of Latino and indigenous descent.
What do you think that KBOO listeners should do to get involved in this issue?
Join an organization fighting for justice. You know what I mean? We know that we can't do this as individuals, that no individual can stand against the police brutality. We know that once we are isolated, that we're more victimized, but as a group and as a force and with strong organization, you can draw attention to these issues.
Do you see parallels with Ferguson here in Portland?
Oh, I see it everywhere. I see it in corporations, I see it in churches, I see it in schools, I see it in our so-called institutions. It's everywhere, and it's perverted, and it's gross, and it's disgusting.
What can we do about it?
Speak. Use your First Amendment rights and speak and talk and write and do art. And art speaks loudly, loudly. Art speaks to our soul, it speaks to our mind. Music. It should be said in music, it should be said in paintings, it should be said in poetry, it should be said over and over and over. This is an injustice. A great, great injustice. And if you're not disturbed, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you if
seeing a young man laying on the street for more than 4 hours doesn't disturb you. I'm disturbed by your not being disturbed. I'm incensed that we're not disturbed, that more of us are not disturbed. Are you not incensed by that?
Those were the voices of protesters who marched in outer southeast Portland last night to call for an end to police violence in Portland and across the United States.
Last October, 20 residents of Curry County, Oregon, filed complaints with the Oregon Departments of Forestry and Agriculture after they were sprayed with herbicide from a helicopter. The follow-up investigation by the Department of Agriculture took nearly 6 months and focused primarily on reaching a verdict against the helicopter pilot, who was issued a $10,000 fine and a year-long license suspension. Meanwhile, the 20 residents who were sprayed were not told the name of the chemical, even as their symptoms persisted. According to the Oregonian, Curry County residents complained 4 times prior to October 2013 about aerial spraying. State agencies treated those complaints as the words of, quote, rogue citizens, in the opinion of one of the residents. The 20 complainants from the incident last October were too many for the agencies to ignore, but it still took them a week to respond and even longer to initiate and close an investigation. Back in April, KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with John Burns, a Gold Beach volunteer firefighter, about the spraying incident and the governmental response, as well as his neighbors and disappointment with the state's investigation.
About how many people got sick in this event?
Well, it started off the first day that it happened, October 16th, as the helicopter flew over and was dropping product on top of us. Some of us were working outside, and a lot of people were gone to work and some were home and were inside. Then as the day advanced on into the evening, I got really sick because I was outside when the helicopter was about 200 feet above me, went over the top of me, and I smelled a bad odor. And then later I kept noticing that it was going back and forth across the top of us. Then I smelled the odor again, another 40 minutes or whatever later, and another pass went by us, and I still didn't think much about it until my neighbor across the road, he came over right after that, and he said, "Did you just get sprayed by a helicopter?" I said, "Is that what all that's about?" Because I was outside working, and I was sweating and everything, too, and I didn't really feel a mist or anything like that, but I sure smelled it. And so anyway, going on to that evening, I got really sick. My neighbors got sick. And from that point on, from day by day, more and more of us in our community here found out that all of us were sick. And then horses and animals were sick, too. So a combination of all these things started coming together. And we had a couple people in the community that was emailing people around to kind of let and Facebook to let us know that, you know, what was going on in the community from family to family. And so as things progressed from that point on, I ended up taking the charge and kind of representing the whole group overall and taking it from that point on and finding out why we all want to know what the stuff was that was dropped on us. And we wanted to know, you know, what we can do about it. So we went to healthcare providers, and we also we started from the very beginning with the health department, and they said that they were too small and they couldn't handle this thing, and so for us to contact the Department of Agriculture and PARC. We called in, we got claim numbers assigned to our case, and then from that point on, it just kept accumulating time and more sicknesses, more animals. We have a colt that's blind. And another horse, an older horse, that's lost 400 to 500 pounds. One dog's dying. The next week after that it happened, Department of Ag actually came out and took samples off of 4 of our properties. And then we waited and waited and waited and waited and waited and kept asking for the information of what the product is so we could also tell our health providers. Some were trying to find out, and they had no way that anybody were able to help them. The poison control, nobody could tell them, "Well, we first have to know what the product is before we can tell you." You know, well, that's what we were trying to find out. So that went on, and after a while we decided to, well, we got hooked up with Lisa Arkin with the Beyond Toxics, and she helped us then start the progression of letters and petitions and everything else in order to put pressure on the Department of Ag to let us know what the product is. So that still didn't help. And so finally we were able to get 10 senators that would want to help us and have the Department of Ag release the information. Also, the governor's assistant, finally the state attorney general, wrote a letter to the and notified the Department of Agriculture, you know, you are misrepresenting the laws, that, you know, this is not a secrecy thing. You know, these people have the right to know what they were hit with. And they claimed all this time that they were still doing an investigation. That's why they wouldn't give us the information, what they were trying to find, or what we were hit with. And so they finally released the information.
About how long did it take for the state to begin responding to your complaints?
Well, we called the day after the incident happened. We started calling ODA and Park. And so from that point on, like I said, it took them a week before they got anybody down here. It was the following week that they had anybody here on site taking samples. My property and my neighbor across the road, ours were the only two properties that showed the chemical that came up on our vegetation. However, there are a lot more properties after that that we found out that a lot more damage was done than even in ours. Dr. Pitchford, you can see where the product went right across his grass and right across the horse corrals and stuff, and that's where the horse ended up getting blind, and all that grass died where it dripped and ran streaks across it. And wow. The only thing that's grown back since then is moss.
That was John Burns speaking with KABU reporter Sam Bowman in April and about the spraying of herbicides on residential communities in Curry County. In the wake of these events, Burns and his neighbors have brought suit against Crook Timberlands and other timber-related companies. The suit will challenge the constitutionality of Oregon's lax regulations on aerial spraying of herbicides, which impose no mandatory buffer zone around residential areas and no maximum wind speed. By contrast, Washington State requires a 200-foot buffer around homes where no spraying can take place, in addition to setting a maximum wind speed of 7 miles per hour. The Curry County citizens, along with Beyond Toxics, have also lobbied state legislators, led by Portland Democrat Michael Dembrow, to enhance the way residents are notified of scheduled herbicide drops. Dembrow plans to introduce legislation that will also streamline the complaint process. Currently, 8 state agencies play a role in herbicide regulation.
On Wednesday, a coalition of environmental, farming, and food watchdog groups have filed suit against the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States Court of Appeals. They are insisting that the court set aside the EPA's approval of Enlist Duo, an herbicide developed by the company Dow AgroSciences, a subsidiary of Dow Chemical. They claim that the EPA's approval was a rubber stamp and that the agency failed to adequately investigate the potential health and environmental effects of Enlist Duo, whose chemical name is 2,4-D. The plaintiffs claim that 2,4-D poses threats to human and animal health and that the approval is a violation of the Endangered Species Act and the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. A separate case brought by the Natural Resources Defense Council a week ago claims that 2,4-D would be disastrous for migrating monarch butterfly populations. Enlist Duo was developed by the Dow Chemical Company to be used on Dow's recently approved herbicide-resistant corn and soybean varieties. Yes, Dow Chemical. The plaintiffs point to problems resulting from the application of Monsanto's herbicide Roundup, which has resulted in the proliferation of herbicide-resistant weeds. The suit was brought by the Center for Food Safety and the environmental law firm Earth Justice on behalf of the coalition. The EPA and Dow Chemical have both expressed confidence that the approval will be upheld.
Antibiotics given to animals to make them healthy may be having the opposite effect. according to a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, giving animals antibiotics can make them sicker and more likely to spread salmonella. The study, conducted at Stanford University, found researchers giving antibiotics to mice infected with salmonella. The antibiotics did not help the mice, and researchers found an increase of salmonella in their excrement. The researchers gave the mice two different antibiotics, both of which made them sick. They believe that the mice's reaction will likely hold true for livestock as well. The meat and dairy industry in the U.S. use a large number of antibiotics in animal feed given to cows, chickens, and other animals raised for meat, milk, and eggs. The new study brings up the question of the role this antibiotic-laced feed may have played in recent outbreaks of salmonella that spanned several states and made thousands of people sick.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland. He'll be speaking about the City of Portland's appeal of the settlement between the city and the United States Department of Justice. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. And at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is going to be rainy, with a projected rainfall of about a quarter of an inch. The temperatures will range between 51 and 59 degrees. Today in history, in 1861, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus for all military-related cases. This meant that suspects could be detained without proof of authority to detain them. A little more than 100 years later, in 1973, a United Nations-brokered ceasefire ended the Yom Kippur War between Israel and Syria, and a final ceasefire 2 days later between Israel and Egypt ended the war completely. The quote of the day is from Roberto Bolaño. If you're going to say what you want to say, you're going to hear what you don't want to hear.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's an unusual uber-rich guy with an unusual message for his fellow 1% of the 1%ers. Nick Hanauer, who made billions as an internet entrepreneur, recently wrote in an open letter to other uber-richies that, quote, "The true job creators are middle-class consumers, not rich business people like us. America is dependent on a strong middle class," he says, "for it's their purchases that power the economy," noting that, "I earn about 1,000 times the median American annually, but I don't buy thousands of times more stuff." He points out that his family has 3 cars, not 3,000. So, Hanauer says, it's in the self-interest of America's corporate and financial elites to do all they can to lift wages, starting with a $15 an hour minimum wage. The old claim that paying workers more will destroy small businesses and halt job growth is simply not true, he says, adding that it's insidious to claim that helping the rich get richer is good for the economy, but helping the poor get richer is bad for it. Hanauer points out that, quote, "The two cities in the nation with the highest rate of job growth by small businesses are San Francisco and Seattle, which also have the two highest minimum wage levels in the country." To the coke-headed ideologues who say any minimum wage is just too much big government, this member of the Billionaires Club says the soundest way to shrink government is to decrease the need for it. Pay decent wages so people don't need food stamps, rent assistance, and other subsidies for life's basics. This is Jim Hightower saying, Hanauer concludes with this sobering warning to obtuse billionaires. No society can survive the glaring inequities we are building into the American economy. Stop these futile low-wage policies and bridge the widening divide, or, quote, "The pitchforks are going to come for us." You can reach Nick Hanauer at nick@secondave.com.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
The largest Ebola outbreak in history continues and is no longer completely confined to West Africa. A man identified as Dr. Craig Allen Spencer, who recently worked for Doctors Without Borders in West Africa, was placed in isolation today at a New York City hospital after exhibiting Ebola-like symptoms. The total number of Ebola patients treated outside of West Africa has now risen to at least 17. 8 of these cases have been here in the United States. A local Tigard nonprofit called Medical Teams International, or MTI, has been working to help control the spread of the disease globally by improving treatment and prevention efforts in Liberia, one of the hardest hit of the West African nations. KBU Evening News reporter Wendell Davis had a chance to talk with Joe DiCarlo of MTI about the situation over there.
What's the situation like on the ground right now in Liberia?
We have been on the ground for 10 years. And it was a natural fit for us in order to continue to help with the health sector in that country when the Ebola crisis arose. So currently we are providing Ebola education at the community level to keep communities safe, at the home level in order to keep families safe, and at the clinic level in order to keep doctors and nurses safe. So that the clinics remain open, provide services not only for Ebola patients, but also for those who are dying from diseases that normally they would be treated, but the clinics have been closed because of Ebola.
How many people do you have over there right now?
We have 48 staff members working on the ground. They're working in small teams, providing training to local community health workers on Ebola, and also to monitor the triage unit of a health facility to make sure that the doctors and nurses remain safe as they examine patients.
How do you respond to the mainstream media reports that blame the culture of Liberia and West Africa for the Ebola crisis?
Well, I would say that would be very unfair. I believe that what this is showing is that the healthcare system in West Africa has been quite weak for some time. Ebola is new to West Africa, so they're unfamiliar with the disease. It's occurred in other places in Africa and East Africa, and they're usually able to contain it very quickly. This has not been the case in West Africa, and partly because of the weak healthcare system they have.
And how did Medical Teams International get started in Liberia?
We began back in 2003 following a civil war that had occurred there. And we were providing mobile medical units to people who were displaced as a result of that war. So this Ebola crisis has really caused the country to take a step back.
What do you think of the response so far from the U.S. and the world in general?
Yeah, I think when we look at West Africa and Liberia in particular, we have a choice. We have two choices. We can isolate ourselves from the situation out of fear and run from it, or we could face the challenges as a world community, rise up, mobilize, and make a difference. And I'm confident that people in the Northwest want the latter. They want to rise up, mobilize, and make a difference. And we can do that. Medical Teams International is doing that. And I know that this problem can be solved if we all work together.
That was Joe DiCarlo with Medical Teams International. My name is Wendell Davis, reporting for the KBOO Evening News.
This afternoon, a tornado touched down in Cowlitz County, Washington, including within the city limits of Longview and Kelso. No injuries have been reported yet, but winds as high as 50 miles per hour uprooted trees, bent street signs, snapped power lines, and sent debris crashing through windows. The tornado reportedly touched down and left the ground repeatedly before finally disappearing back into the clouds around 1:30. In other weather-related news, yesterday's storm shattered the previous record of 1.3 inches of rain in 1951. Rainfall at Portland International Airport yesterday exceeded 1.8 inches. The Portland Bureau of Environmental Services released a statement that the large volume of stormwater runoff has triggered a sewer overflow into the Willamette River. Since Portland's sewer system combines sewage and stormwater runoff, the overflow contains bacteria from untreated sewage. Residents are advised to avoid contact with the Willamette River for the next 48 hours and wash their hands after any contact. The alert extends from the Selwood Bridge to the Willamette's confluence with the Columbia. Severe weather warnings, including high winds and possible tornadoes, are in effect for much of southwest Washington, the Oregon coast, and the Willamette Valley.
Tigard City Council candidates will appear in an election forum that starts at 7 p.m. tonight at the Tigard Grange, located at 13770 Southwest Pacific Highway. The forum is sponsored by Tigard First, a group that originally formed in opposition to the Walmart opening its Tigard store. In November 4th general election, Tigard voters will choose two city councilors from among four candidates: incumbent Mark Woodard, whose term expires December 31st, Thomas Anderson, John Goodhouse, and Carl Switzer. The top two vote-getters will win council seats. Tigard Mayor John Cook, elected to his first term back in 2012, is running for re-election unopposed. Cook has also been invited to the forum. Councillor Gretchen Buhner, whose term expires December 31st, is not seeking re-election. Council President Marlon Henderson and Councillor Jason Snyder's terms run through the end of 2016. Tonight's forum will be unscripted and will allow attendees to ask questions of the candidates directly, according to a news release from the group. If you aren't able to attend but are interested in hearing the forum, it will be posted on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and will also be broadcast on KBOO Radio next Friday, October 31st.
This past weekend, Palestinian rights supporters in Portland held a protest outside the Trailblazers preseason basketball game. They were protesting the decision by the Blazers to play against a team from Israel. Protesters chanted, "Basketball's political when you play with Israel," and called for a boycott of Israeli sports teams to try to pressure Israel to end its occupation of Palestine. KBOO reporters were on the scene and bring us the voices of the protesters.
The Maccabees.
Okay, so what's dangerous about the Maccabees is that they're part of a PR tour that Israel has sent this basketball team on, and they've sent this team before too, and it's part of Israeli propaganda to paint the Israeli state as a state that is friendly, that is cooperative, that is peaceful, that wants peace, when really that's not the case. The case is that they've been in peace talks for years without proper Palestinian representation. And so the case is that Israel is an oppressive state that blocks movement of Palestinians, discriminates based on ethnicity, discriminates based on race. And sending teams like this to the U.S. is a part of their propaganda.
What are some of the things that people have said as they walk by?
Do you know how badly it
hurts? What is the vibe, and has it been mostly just kind of like passive? And
Mostly passive. A few people have said, you make me sick or something, you know, but mostly it's people kind of ignoring, just kind of want to get to the basketball game. And I do think it's hard to explain to people in the moment why, you know, because a cultural boycott is kind of hard to explain with, you know, a 2-minute passerby, if that. Sometimes you get 20 seconds.
What's your name? Full name?
Ned Roche.
How old are you?
64.
Nice. And you're with Jewish Voice for Peace,
correct? Correct.
So what are you doing here today?
Well, I'm here because it just seems to me that we all need to take a stand. And when we see oppression happening anywhere in the world, it's our responsibility, especially when we're Americans and complicit in the occupation, the siege, the brutality of what Palestinians live with on a daily basis. And when you're Jewish, there's an added responsibility because Israel claims to speak in our name.
What has been the response today by people where you have been? You've been over there, right? Yeah. Has it been mostly passive? Have people said things?
I think it's been mostly passive. I think most people are here to see a game and really don't care. One person told me to get a life, but a whole bunch of people asked for the literature, gave us the thumbs up when they saw our signs and the Palestinian flag.
It seems like you have a very strong connection to this cause. Is there a reason for that?
Somehow I just got deep into my heart, seeing, you know, faces of children, like, laughing even, and that much, devastating situation, that much oppression. They're still smiling.
And how long have you lived in Portland?
10 years.
10 years.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, 10 years. And I'm new in the Palestinian cause. 2 years. 2 years. Only on Facebook. I've been on Facebook, very active on Facebook. And this is my first demonstration, and I'm so happy to be here.
That's great.
So happy.
What has been the response from people that are walking into the game?
So many people that don't really understand. They're just saying, what is that? Just like I told you, media has been so silent, they don't know anything about it. Some are curious, some they ask you, some they just walk by. They just think there's another, you know, crazy people protesting for whatever. Yeah, but they don't really know the reason why we're here. If they could stop a little to ask, they wouldn't know. And there is good people in this world. They will understand Palestinians exist, and they resist.
Yeah,
they
sure. Resist. Last question.
Sure.
Tell me about the weather.
The weather is lovely. to be honest, I don't like the rain. I like the rain, but not on me.
Yeah.
But for Palestine, I'll do anything. Anything.
That was the sound of a protest at the Portland Trail Blazers game against an Israeli team this past weekend.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, October 23rd, 2014. Israeli settlers take over Palestinian lands in West Bank and clashes continue in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Thursday, the Israeli military confiscated 20 dunums, approximately 5 acres of Palestinian-owned land, located near the illegal settlement block of Ariel in the northern occupied West Bank. Israeli bulldozers in the Palestinian village of Haris near the Burkan settlement on Thursday began raising some 20 dunums of agricultural land, while dozens of Israelis from the nearby Ariel came to participate in destroying the fields. A statement from the Salafit governorate said that the land, located near the village of Burkin, had been under threat since the owners were served with an eviction order in 2013, which stated that the land was Israeli state property. According to local news sources, the seizure and destruction of Palestinian agricultural resources comes on the same day the Palestinian officials working in the coordination with the local committee against Israel's separation wall and settlements announced that they had succeeded in saving 15 dunums of land from confiscation just a few kilometers away in the southern western part of the Ariel settlement block. In related news, UN's OCHA agency official James Rolway stated Thursday that the ongoing settler violence, in conjunction with recurring access restrictions imposed by the Israeli authorities on Palestinians, continue to negatively impact their lives and livelihoods. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli settlers attacked overnight several Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem and attacked residents, cars and homes with stones, sticks and sharp objects. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan said that settler groups hurled stones at cars, homes and property, causing excessive property damage before attacking and wounding several Palestinians. The center added that the clashes, lasting all night, took place between Israeli soldiers and local Palestinians in various neighborhoods, alleys and towns in occupied Jerusalem, especially in Silwan, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque, Shu'afat Refugee Camp, Mount of Olives, and the Suwana neighborhood. Silwan is the town where Abdulrahman Shaludi, 20, was shot and seriously injured on Wednesday by tram Israeli guards and died from his wounds shortly after midnight at the Israeli hospital. Shaludi was shot by 3 rounds of live ammunition, one directly in his liver. He reportedly tried to hit Israeli settlers at the tram station with his car. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, October 23rd, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Wendell Davis, Susan Cecil, and Kelly Lynn. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Curry County Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Sari Gametta.
And I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO Radio at 7, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. They look at Gamergate as the latest example of backlash against feminism. At 9, One Land, Many Voices looks at Palestinian Americans and the fight for justice in Palestine and U.S. activism with follow-up reports on the cases of Tarek Abu Khtir and Stephen Saleta, and an activist roundup on solidarity work nationally and locally. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Suzanne LeGrand hosts Startup City with a focus on new opportunities for jobs in the tech industry. At 11:10 a.m. tomorrow, host Sarika Mehta speaks with Rick Steves, host of Rick Steves' Europe, about his support for Oregon ballot measure number 91, the marijuana measure, and with journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas about his support for Oregon ballot measure 88, driver cards. At 11:30, Chris Andre is back to discuss Imago Theater's production of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your continuing support of KBOO Radio. And stay tuned now for an interview with Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Good night, Sarika.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking now with Jason Renaud with Mental Health Association of Portland. And I am wondering if you have some thoughts on the Portland City Council vote yesterday evening to continue this appeal on the judge's ruling on the police reforms, that the judge had asked for an annual report to the judge. What do you think about the decision by the Portland City Council last night?
Well, we're very disappointed in the council and their decision to continue to stall and avoid responsibility for the harms caused by the Portland Police Bureau.
And it seems unusual that all four city council members decided to approve this. Why do you think that is?
Well, they listened to the city attorney and not to the community members who came and gave long and heartfelt testimony yesterday. They are enthralled with their bottom line and not with what's going on in the community.
So what does this vote actually mean? What will happen next?
The vote asks for clarification from the Ninth Circuit Court to Judge Simon's order that the city and its community compliance officer, community liaison, come and give an annual report to in his court. The answer by Simon is a little bit unclear, but the conversation between the city, the Department of Justice, and Simon was quite vigorous. So my guess is that this was a debated topic before the settlement agreement was reached, and the city just didn't like it all the way along and intended to appeal from the beginning.
And why did the judge request an annual review in front of the judge?
In February, the judge had a hearing about the settlement and the findings, and he heard from community members for two solid days a mistrust of the city, not of the police bureau, but of City Hall itself and its foot-dragging and inability to be accountable to the community. So we had hoped that the judge would hold some powers over the continuing settlement and be able to bring some better order to the process, some more accountability.
And for people who aren't familiar with this settlement between the City of Portland and the U.S. Justice Department, could you just give our listeners a little bit of background?
Oh, yes. It's quite a unique settlement. The Department of Justice Civil Rights Division routinely investigates police bureaus for civil rights violations, typically use of force, and that's gone on in about 10 cities over the past 5 years. But in Portland, the unique understanding is that the police were found to have a pattern and practice of harming persons with mental illness. And that's a very different conclusion than the DOJ found in other cities. So between the city and the Department of Justice, they negotiated a lengthy settlement, which will bring supposedly a large number of changes in police policy and practice and training in community oversight of the police and perhaps even changes to the mental health system.
As someone who advocates for people with mental health issues, what do you see as some of the main issues between the Portland police and the people of the city?
Well, the Portland police have had undertrained their officers and were under-resourced by the community to provide services for people with mental illness. They didn't understand them. They didn't have places to take them. They didn't have skills to help them, and those are hopefully coming in this settlement agreement.
Have there been changes since the Justice Department investigation?
Well, anecdotally, I think yes. When you talk on the street with officers, they are far more attuned to the interests of people with mental illness than they were, say, 8 or 9 years ago. But when you talk to people with mental illness, they're still just as afraid of the police officers as they were before. There's still really no trust at all between the mental health community and the police officers.
Your group is among a number that are opposed to this appeal by the City of Portland. What are some of the other groups that are involved in this?
Well, our partners in this process have been, for a long time, the ACLU of Oregon and the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Peace and Justice Reform. So these organizations and several others, Jobs for Justice was there yesterday, and others have been watching this case very closely and following the various decisions by City Hall.
And if the reforms were to be carried out under the settlement, do you think that will be sufficient, that the settlement is provides enough changes, enough retraining, that it will make an impact on the police interactions with people with mental illness?
Not at all, no. We disagreed with the DOJ from the very beginning. We thought that their emphasis was in retraining officers entirely missed the mark. The persons were harmed by individual officers and not by the police force as a whole. Until you hold individual officers accountable, not only in the disciplinary process within the police bureau, but also in criminal court, then the assurance is not to the community that these particular officers will not do this again. This is a sort of a significant misunderstanding that City Hall has balked at really for many years now, over a decade.
And why do you think there is so much resistance in City Hall to reforming the police department? Is there pressure coming from the police union on them?
Well, I think the police union has some pressure, but I think that the city bargained away a lot of its ability to communicate and negotiate about these issues years ago in exchange for concessions on salary increases and benefits increases. So the police union has been very intelligent and has been very good at the bargaining table, and there's it's very hard to turn things around at this point. So this problem has been in the brewing for decades.
And the city council, all four, as I mentioned earlier, voted for appealing the judge's rule, and including Dan Saltzman, whose objection initially was that it was bad publicity for the city.
Well, that's right. This shows the sort of social naivete of these individuals who run our city. They really don't understand that this legalistic solution doesn't solve the social problem. And they're sort of enthralled with their city attorney, and they haven't spoken to their personal psychologist or spiritual advisor in a while.
Well, one of the things that's been in the news nationally is the militarization of police and weapons that have gotten in the hands of the police that are then used on people who are often unarmed and often not a threat to the police or to the community. What do you think of this excessive use of force and increased use of military-style weaponry? Is that an issue here in Portland?
Well, for our people, for people with a mental illness, these weapons and uniforms and vehicles are terrifying. They don't invite us to have an open dialogue with police officers. They are instruments of fear and terror, and they're inappropriate in an urban setting.
If you were to get the settlement that you had hoped for, what would that consist of?
That would consist very simply of those individual officers having being accountable for their actions, not the entire police bureau, not the idea of police reform, but those individual officers. And the second thing we'd hope for is that police officers and jail deputies and city council politicians would be our allies in seeking better mental health treatments and services throughout our community.
It seems, just from watching the funding in the city of Portland, that there is a decrease in the amount of mental health services available, that cuts have been made. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I think the bean counters down in Salem would say that the money is about the same and the number of slots are about the same. But frankly, the number of people who are homeless on the streets is going up. And the number of people who are unable to get services for mental illness is going up. Even though more people have insurance today, it didn't magically make more agencies and clinicians available. So we're still far behind primary care and other sorts of health care systems. And because people with mental illness have a multiplicity of costs and concerns, this makes it more complicated for us than the average healthcare system.
And so what happens next? The city is going to file its appeal by next Tuesday. And what are the next steps for the community groups involved?
Well, I think the appeal will go on its own course. And currently the city attorney is saying she is not going to also request a stay, which would cease and halt the reform process that may or may not already be underway. And then we'll continue with the hiring of the COCL position, the compliance officer of the settlement agreement. And then perhaps the city council will form a community board of persons to also report out to the community about the changes that are going on with the police bureau. If you ask the police bureau, a lot of things have already changed, and they are well underway with these changes. Really, until we have an independent and impartial investigation of those and report to the community, we don't actually know. But it may be that a lot of things have already been accomplished.
Would the city's proposal of having the city official as the arbiter allow for that kind of annual report, or does it have to be a judge?
Well, the compliance officer will report by letter to city council. Whether that letter will be made public or not is unknown. Whether there'll be open hearings or not is unknown. Because we don't know who the compliance officer will be, we don't know whether they'll meet with the community. There's one set that will actually be in Chicago, one applicant for the position who will live in Chicago, and I guess we'll have to go there to speak to them. So we don't really know how it will be reported to the community.
So I'm guessing your hope and the hope of many other leaders of community groups is that this appeal will be denied and that the annual hearing will have to be in front of the judge, Judge Simon.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speculate on the viability of the appeal, but yes, we do hope the appeal is denied.
Well, thanks so much, Jason Renaud. I have been speaking with Jason Renaud. He's the head of the Mental Health Association of Portland, one of the more than 20 community groups that have spoken out in opposition to the city's appeal of the section of judge's settlement with the city that the city officials and Portland police actually report every year to the judge on the progress of how police reforms are going in relation to the judgment against the city of Portland by the Justice Department. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jason Renaud on KBOO.
Thank you, Jenka.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor.